The Winners Club is the weekly podcast that shares the highlights and insights from some of the most meaningful and impactful conversations from the number one community on Clubhouse, The Winners Club.
So, very warm welcome this morning, guys. We're just going to quickly reset. This is the Breakfast with Winners Room, brought to you by The Winners Club. And as Paul mentioned, we're now about to have a deep dive conversation with a lady who has got an exceptionally impressive CV. She has done some amazing stuff with some amazing companies all around the world. A global CMO. We'll be diving into the backstory and the knowledge of Julie Lyle in a couple of minutes' time. This is going to be a bit of an interview, a bit of a deep dive. We're also then going to do Q&A with the panel, and then we're also going to stick the hand raise open in the room as well. So if you've ever wanted to speak to a lady like Julie, who's held CEO, board director, investor, Fortune 50, retail, CPD, fintech, gaming, esports, AI, data science, and CMO roles for some of the biggest brands on the planet, then you can ask questions shortly. But ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, if you are on the stage, give it a round of applause, give it a flash of the mic. Julie Lyle's on the show. Oh, wow. That was an energetic start, wasn't it? Julie Lyle, are you there, my friend?
I am. Can you hear me?
We can indeed. We can hear you loud and clear. Thank you for being here. So Julie is a global executive board member, director, advisor, investor and entrepreneur. I'm going to read the first little portion of her LinkedIn bio. Passionate about market leading technologies that drive meaningful relationships between brands and customers, all in on AI, blockchain, branded cryptocurrency, IoT and data science, where it adds value to customers, investors and shareholders. Julie's held positions like CMO for the likes of Barnes & Noble, and she was also the global CMO over at Walmart. I say over at, like I've been there. Like, just over at Walmart. Sorry, Julie. I've made it very, very friendly straight away, haven't I? But tell us, Julie, take us back to the beginning of your journey. How did you can look at the accolades of a person like yourself and you can go, wow, she's got it all together. How did your journey begin, my friend? How did you become the Julie Lyle that we all know today?
Goodness. Well, I'd love to tell you that it was far more planned than it actually was, but there was quite a bit of happenstance in my career. Although I did ultimately follow people from one position to the next. In my early career, I actually had my own business. I had a marketing and business development firm, which I built and ran for 11 years, and then sold to Gleason Cleese, which flipped it to Leo Burnett. So I had an early exit. Pretty early in my career, and then I just started taking pretty senior roles in marketing and business development because I'd had some successes both with my own firm and would build them as I would go from one to the next. When I joined Raytheon, I was at the time, which was probably my first big corporate role. There really weren't a lot of women in executive leadership roles that had a lot of international experience. And I think that had a lot to do with my early beginnings into large corporate environments.
When you were sort of a younger person, when you were sort of doing the college and university thing, was running your own business always going to be the way that you wanted to go? Or was it something you stumbled across? What did you study, and what was the dream as 18-year-old Julie?
Absolutely not. I was actually pretty early into university, but I was convinced for the majority of my childhood that I was going to be an international contract attorney. And so my undergraduate and graduate studies were in law. And I was one semester into law school and ran out of money, frankly. And I was on a pretty fast track program for a MBA, LLM, and a Juris Doctorate degree, but I didn't have the cash to continue, and they wouldn't let me work and carry that workload at school. So I had to quit and just go get a sales job. They called it an account executive, made it sound very, very grandiose to someone right out of school, but it was actually, I got a headset, a cubicle, and a cold call list, and that was the beginning of my foray into sales and marketing.
So how come they wouldn't let you continue with the university studies just because it was going to be too much alongside having to have a job to pay your way sort of thing?
Absolutely. And I was pretty young. I was still under 20 years old, and I had my bachelor's degree and was beginning the law program with a university that had very high visibility, and they gave me a full scholarship. And they were afraid that because of my youth and the heavy workload of getting both an MBA and the LLM, that plus physical work would it be too much. And they needed, I think they were worried about the visibility of their program.
So you mentioned sort of as a childhood dream, it was going to be sort of a contract lawyer. Not all kids think, oh, do you know what? I'm going to be a contract lawyer. What was your background? What did mum and dad do back in the day? Was there some sort of lead into the world of law from your parents, or how did that become the dream?
Really not at all. I'm not really sure where the spark for law came from, but I believe it had to do, most people don't realize, I was actually born in Brazil. My parents are American, but I was born in Brazil and lived there for the majority of my childhood throughout South Central America, and then came to the States, and I had some hearing problems early as a child. And so languages, learning languages and learning to be able to write and to perform, school and whatnot in a language that was not necessarily your first language or that you weren't comfortable with was important to me. And the reason that relates to your question is I learned early on how important the difference between where a comma was placed or how words were strung together could influence documents, contracts, as well as negotiations and whatnot. And I think that has stuck with me. I know it stuck with me the rest of my career, but I think that has that was a big factor in my initial attraction to law and studying in that regard.
So you go from the sort of the contract law degree into the need for an account executive, which is a grandiose title for a cold calling person in a cubicle. How did you go from the sort of the cold calling to marketing agency? Because by the sounds of it, from the sort of the exit of your business, that all happened quite quickly, it would seem. So how did you get from cold call cubicle into your own business?
Well, I started working for a company that was called the Hart Group, and it was actually the founder of the Hart Group, who was an incredible, wonderful mentor. It was a true blessing to have, his name was Mitch Hart, and to have him as an early boss was I'm sure a part of what catapulted my career. But he was one of the early members of the Young Presidents Organization, and he and Ross Perot were founders of EDS, and he was very influential and quite a venture capital and influential individual and a great leader. I just was very successful. I was very determined. I worked very, very hard in sales. I took, they gave me a very difficult region that was upside down. I turned it around to the point that we not only had incredible sales, but opened up new manufacturing facilities to support the sales, and then ultimately sold that business out of his portfolio very successfully. And then I went to the holding company, and he literally called me down to the office on a Friday and said, would you like to handle marketing, advertising, and public relations for all of the five holding companies? And I said, sure. I had no idea what it was, but he said, well, then great. Just you'll start Monday. We'll move your office down here. And he did. And so I had to learn it as I went. And I think I've learned every job I've taken that way ever since.
Fantastic. What a brilliant journey. I've got one more question, because I could talk to you for hours, but I've got to open it up to the audience, because it's only the polite thing to do, and we're very polite, us Brits. But I'm really intrigued. So you went very quickly from sort of the cold calling cubicle into running a successful marketing agency, and that tenacity drove that success that you had to the point where you exited the business. Was there I imagine there would have been, what was the biggest sort of mindset shift that you had to go through from being a very successful young entrepreneur to becoming then a successful intrapreneur? So when you take that entrepreneurial spirit, but then you had to go and work inside somebody else's business, was there a mentality shift that you had to make there? Or was it the same sort of material focus and drive that you just apply in every area by the sounds of it?
That's a great question. I believe there was a bit of a unique mindset, and at least in my case, and what it was when I had that opportunity to go and work for Mitch Hart, and to head up the marketing and advertising for all five companies. Again, I was still in my very early 20s, And at this point, I had the chairman of the company who said, who put me in a position where I would functionally support five different CEOs of five very different businesses. And I, because I was doing marketing and PR specifically, I was managing their company's brands, but I was also managing their personal brands of those, each of those CEOs. And yet I functionally reported to each of them, but I, because I administratively reported to the chairman of the board, as a young person in early in her career, I had to learn how to navigate the delicate minefields of each of those CEOs having the competition with their fellow, their colleagues, CEOs in the Hart Group portfolio, and wanting their privacy, wanting all of my attention whenever they wanted it, and not wanting me to be pulled into other businesses to help others when they felt that I should be helping them, as well as how, as a very young person, how do I manage very difficult conversations when they're confiding in me because they had to, about delicate situations, positive and negative, but knowing full well that I also had the ear of their boss. And those, the lessons that you learn in terms of how you navigate relationships and how you deal with very tough conversations and how you manage people's expectations, to learn those lessons that early in my career has served me so well. And I believe it has, I think it was probably one of the cornerstones of my success throughout my career. Did that answer your question?
It did. It's fantastically answered my question. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Right. So I'm going to unselfishly, although I want to just keep asking questions, rapid fire style, but I won't. We're going to open it up to the panel now. We're going to open it up popcorn style flashes of the mic shortly. But before that, we've got some flashing of hands in the studio right now. So Paul, over to you first, and then we're going to go to Lucien.
Hi, Julie. Good to see you again. I'd love to know, all your years of marketing experience, I'd love to know a campaign that stands out for you that really, really worked. And I'd equally like to know a campaign that you thought would work really well, but actually didn't and performed really badly.
Well, one of the campaigns that actually worked really well that I didn't think would work was when we were, it was early in my years with Walmart, and we were trying to really promote the quality of the fresh product in our Asda supercenters in the UK, because there was such a negative stigma of Walmart and poor quality, especially when it came to food and you know, organics or not organics, etc. And so we created this, I would say it was sort of a precursor to the farm to market positioning, and we went throughout Northern England and Wales, and we literally put sandwich cloths, placards, and blankets, if you will, on sheep and cows in meadows, and promoted our new farm-to-table offering of local farmers' cheeses and local farmers' proteins and beef and lamb, etc. And just let the animals carry the placards around in the fields as they grazed. And it was a massive hit, and really told the story very well. So that's sort of a very tactical, let's just analog marketing campaign, but it was wildly successful. One that didn't work, let's see. Oh gosh. Well, there were several. When I first went to, I took the role with Prudential PLC as their global chief marketing officer and head of government relations at the height of the global financial crisis in Asia. And it was so important because the rest of the Western, you know, Europe and North America, which were the lion's share of the portfolio's sales and profits, were being just squeezed so tightly in 2008, 2009 with regulations. For the insurance business, that we had to find a way to really accelerate the growth in Asia and solve our brand issues as well. And we lived by at that point what was we called it a trademark coexistence agreement with Prudential Financial Inc. And it was one of those most very challenging situations where agreements that were written by attorneys in closed rooms decades before we had a digital world or a global economy that defined who could use what word and what trademark in what geographic area literally by geographic boundaries, was really a hindrance to our success. And I wrote a marketing program actually to leverage Manchester United to gain awareness for the difference between Prudential PLC versus Prudential Financial across Asia and the Middle East, North Africa region. But the board had approved it, but the way that our group chief executive at that time wanted to negotiate the deal, it fell apart with Manchester, and another insurance company took the program and took the entire sponsorship package and sponsored the kit for Manchester and got all the publicity that we were hoping that we would get.
Brilliant. Thanks, Jeff. I think they're still the sponsor now, aren't they? I think for Manchester United, there's a big insurance brand on the front of their shirts.
I'm not sure who's doing it now, but at the time, in fact, the COO for Prudential PLC, his name was Sandeep. He was the COO of Prudential at the time. And right about that time, he left to take over the CEO position with Aon. And he realized how critical that program was. He took it with him. So he took over the position and took it right out from underneath our noses.
It is Aon now still, I believe, laps. Yeah.
Julie's laughing about it now. I imagine there was not a lot of laughter about it at the time.
No, in fact, I remember at the time someone getting thrown in a pool and a jersey being thrown right after him in Hong Kong at a cocktail party. Because it was at that time, it was £60 million. It was a very large campaign.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you, Julie. So Lucy N is here with us in the studio opposite me. She has a question as well.
Yeah. Hello, Julie. It's lovely to hear you again. And thanks for being with us and taking these questions. So we were talking earlier to female empowerment, and you've been there, done that, got the T-shirt. And I asked this question of any woman of prominence. What do you see as being exceptional practice in balancing the male-female quota in organisations? Have you seen something brilliant that you could share with us around how organisations are supporting women to thrive in corporate?
Well, I've seen a number of initiatives that I think are making a difference and that are helpful. I guess on a larger scale, what I would say is that, and I say this very, very thoughtfully, but there was a time in my career when I really was very much against the idea of quotas. And I would tell you from the heart, I still, in a way, bristle at the thought that you need to force people to hit certain numbers, and that's how you can change the balance of power or shift the facade, if you will, of an organization to really be more inclusive and genuinely have representation of whether it's women or people of color or nationalities, religions, well, everything, right? There was a time when I was really I didn't support that. I didn't feel good about that. And that probably 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 25 years ago, maybe. But what I came to realize is if you don't implement quotas, it just doesn't happen. And so I support quotas and I support those kinds of mandates now very passionately, because it's the only way to get the pendulum to swing back the other way. So I hope that answers your question. But the one thing I would say that I think is very important that I see implemented in bits in different companies and different initiatives, but I don't think it's implemented strongly enough to really make a difference, is that we're still in many cases in a mindset of one and done. Or if we just put a woman on this board, or if we just bring an executive of color into this position, then we've accomplished our quota, or we've hit our number, we've demonstrated our support for these initiatives. And I think in many cases, it's done in earnest, but it's not just putting the person in the chair. What's important is creating an environment where people who speak differently and who have different points of view that come with the background that is related to them being a woman or a person of color or et cetera, the fact that they speak differently and think differently, you've got to create the environment where that point of view and that contribution is welcomed and nurtured and valued, not just having their behind in the chair, frankly.
Thank you.
I hope that helps.
Yeah, thank you for your honesty and by far the most comprehensive answer I've had. So thank you very much for that, Julie.
Awesome stuff. Thank you, Julie. Right, we're going to... Ash, have you got a question?
Yeah, I just... So I want to say thank you, Julie, for all your time today. And I really want to know is that there's a lot of people in this room on the journey of going through the corporate ladder, going through journey of their business and levelling up. Now, what is that one thing that you would turn around and say to people that can go, that are probably going through hardship, facing challenges? Like, what is it that you live by? How do you overcome these things? Is from where your journey started to where you've achieved now, you must have had to overcome some things in and that have got in the way. So what is your sort of number one thing to when you're facing adversity or challenges?
For me, what I would say is if you really have a goal in mind and you're headed for that goal, I liken it to being a boxer, right? If you want to be a champion boxer, you have to know you're going to get hit. People are going to swing at you and they're going to try to take you out. And that's going to happen when you try to climb any ladder or try to achieve any goal where you're competing with others. You're going to take some hits. And I think the one thing that can be, that was so helpful to me along the way, was to not only know that, but to pay attention to what's happening all around you and to other people. And when you, if you really are in the moment and you watch other people take the hits and you sit with that and you really, you know, you really marinate with that, then when you get your hit, you won't take it so personally. And you'll understand that I'm part of an ecosystem, and these setbacks and these disappointments and these challenges and these unfair situations happen to everybody around me as well as me. And it really matters how I show up the next day or how I get myself up off the floor and swing again that will make me either rise to the top or not. And I think there's actually comfort in understanding that you're not precious. It happens to everyone around you just as well. I hope that answers your question.
Wow, I love that. I love that answer. Thank you for that share. So it's like we're going to get hit, take the hits, grow with the hits, and yeah, be vigilant that it's not just happening to you, it's happening around. So thank you for that share today, Julie, and I will be passing the mic back to James.
Awesome stuff. Right, so mods and speakers on the panel, we're going to do popcorn style. We'll do two or three questions from the panel, then we're going to open it up to people who want to put their hand up in the audience, because we can see there's a big jump in the number of people who've jumped into the room who are listening. We've got, we've had a couple of hundred people jump in, which is fantastic. And over the course of the show so far, I've had about 2,000 people going through the room. So there's obviously a huge appetite for this conversation. So thank you again, Julie, for your time. Mods and speakers, flash your mic if you would like to ask Julie a question. Let's go to the man with the golden touch when it comes to questions, Mr. John O'Brien. Over to you, sir.
Hello, James. Hi, Julie. Hi. I did have one question, which is when are we ever going to get dinner again? But that's another thing. It's been fantastic listening in, and actually, I love your final point there about people taking swings at you, because I think some of the best of us are defined by those people who have taken swings at us. So I think that's great. But I have one question, really, which is related to Clubhouse. Certainly I found it very enriching to be able to reconnect with friends around the world and also meet new friends that I wouldn't necessarily have found through this period of lockdown, etc. But I have two related questions, Julie. One, could you just share with you what Clubhouse has meant to you personally in coming onto this platform? And secondly, what do you think it may mean for brands, which we're still trying to explore? What will it mean for companies and brands as this evolves? Thank you, and I'm done talking.
Thank you, John. John, you've been such a dear friend for so many years, and you've watched me grow. I think we've known each other longer than I realized. I think I did the count. It was like 15 years. So you've seen me grow up. Thanks for hanging with me. So what has it meant to me? What it's meant to me is Clubhouse itself is it's been an opportunity for me to connect with people of all stations, all walks in life, all different stairs or steps on their journey. And I that to me is the greatest appeal. I have always enjoyed being around people of every shape, size, color, sophistication, experience, point of view, etc. It stimulates me. It sparks my creativity. I learn so much. For me, that's what makes me enjoy Clubhouse and want to be a part of it.
If you'd like to ask Julie a question, flash your mic. Let's go to Karen, one of the most lovely voices on Clubhouse. Go on, Karen, what's your question?
Hello. My goodness, Julie, I'm so glad I was here to hear you speak. What I want to ask you, this is a little bit different. I want to ask you, how has your faith, because of God, how do you think your faith has played a role in your career path and the choices you've made and the things you've done? How do you think that has led into it? And the other question that I always like to ask the phenomenal people they bring on the stage, what would you say to young people who are youngpreneurs, even my own two children are youngpreneurs, what would you say to them? So two questions. One is, how has your faith impacted your choices with your career and the endeavors that you've encountered? And what would you say to young entrepreneurs, young ones, I mean, like, you know, 7 and 8, 10, 12, 13-year-olds about being entrepreneurs? This is Karen. I'm done speaking.
Hi, Karen. Thanks so much for the great question. How has my faith has, I'm very delighted, humbled to be a woman of God. And I believe my faith has absolutely been my bedrock for everything I've done and certainly for my career. When I have felt that a challenge I was facing was too much, or when I felt that I was in a situation where I, you know, at the time I was coming up in the ranks, I was very often the only woman in the environment, and sometimes it was very harsh and really very crippling. And many times I wanted to give up, but it was my faith and my belief that I was on a path that was intended for me, not just that I was mapping out, but that it was, I was in the place where I should be. That and just prayer and believing that strength would come to me when I needed it most helped me through. As for the second question, what I would say to young people is you must believe in yourself. You absolutely have to believe that in your core, in that little space that's below your heart and right in your gut, that if you put your mind to it, you can do anything. And the road is absolutely not going to be easy. And most often you will take your worst hit or your worst challenge when you're coming right off the highest high. And it's okay. You can get back up and go again. And by the way, if you are so focused on only one goal, don't limit yourself for the many different opportunities that might be in your peripheral vision. It doesn't mean you shouldn't be focused and driven towards what you believe you want to go after, but there are so many paths in life. And I really believe that when a door closes, a window opens. Be open to the many possibilities. Success and happiness comes in so many forms. Just be open to it. And I believe there's plenty for all of us to find on the other side of our efforts. I hope that answered your question.
Yes, indeed. Excellent. Thank you.
Amazing. Thank you very much. Great stuff there. Modern speakers, popcorn style, give your mics a flash if you'd like to ask a question to Julie. How many times do you get to quiz one of the most successful marketeers on the planet? Not very often, my friend, but we're bringing you this kind of content all the time here in Clubhouse. So yeah, flash your mics if you've got a question you'd love to ask. Let's go to Dale. Dale, what's your question, my friend?
Thank you, James. Hello, Julie. Pleasure to be in your company, technically, I guess. James. Just to jump off the back, kind of, from what Karen asked us there, I love the fact that you've just said self-belief for children, because that's something that I really champion in kids. So my question is, a bit of a technical question, really, if you don't mind answering, is basically, I want to shake up my town, my local town Rugby. I want to shake it up a little bit. I want to be more emphasis on the education system. I want children to be more, to be happier, to live with abundance, to have that self-belief, to learn to stand up for themselves and not be ashamed of who they are. And I'm really looking for help from local businesses to shout about them as well in schools. So I was going to hold a monthly newsletter so that we can shout about what they do. But my question is, over here in the UK, we've got, I'm sure you know this, but we've got a SCR, so Corporate Social Responsibility. My question is, how on earth could I ask or help businesses kind of invest in my project to help champion children by use of their SCR, whether it be funding, whether it be space, products, etc.? Is there a good technique to do? I don't know. I'm a little bit, this is not my area of expertise, so I just wondered if you've had any experience of that in the past. If so, I'm all ears. Thank you, Julie.
Well, thank you for the question, Dale, and kudos to you for focusing on the young people in your communities. That's God's work for sure. It's going to sound a very capital response, but with sponsorships or to get corporates to get involved in these kinds of initiatives, what I have found is the most important is to really understand, to get to know the corporation. I mean, when you target the ones that could do the most value for you, and really get to know them, get people inside the organization that you can forge relationships with, not necessarily the decision maker, people that can give you reconnaissance insights about the culture of the business, what matters to them, et cetera. And then try to figure out how to market, to package the exposure that they will get, to map that to what is important to the business. In some cases, if they have a CSR fund, the CSR fund may have rules or restrictions around will only focus on children with learning disabilities rather than children at large, or we only will focus on children that are hungry as opposed to, you know, the larger, broader community of children, et cetera. But find out not only what the mandates are, but also see if you can find champions in the organization that have young kids that really need that kind of hand up versus a hand out, or someone who's very passionate about mentoring. So individual connections and relationships. But then if it's a company that is really having some challenges with layoffs or things like that in a community, they probably need some goodwill in the community. Find ways that they can solve one of their problems by having the exposure, or they're having a problem with employee turnover and they need to have their employees feel more engaged. Perhaps create one-to-one mentoring opportunities for mid-level managers within the company, or rather than going and asking for the money, try to create a win-win scenario where they get something out of it and the community initiative that you're supporting gets something out of it. And it really becomes a very symbiotic and by that, then very sustainable relationship. I hope that helped.
That massively helped. And you just had made me look into myself as if I'm walking into a company saying, give me your money, it's for the kids. So I think a package is a lot more prudent, actually. So thank you, Julie.
My pleasure.
Awesome stuff. There you go. Where else would you be able to get mentoring from someone like Julie on a Friday morning when it's late on a Thursday for her in the States? Thank you, Julie, again, for making the time. We appreciate it massively. Modern Speakers, it is a rare opportunity to speak to someone who's been the global CMO of such big brands as Julie. So feel free to flash your mics if you'd like to ask a question. Let's go to Marvin. Marvin is flashing away. Go on, mate. What is your question for Julie?
Hi, and thanks for the opportunity to ask a question. Once again, an amazing guest. Julie, it's really nice to connect with you. I'd love to, and apologies if this has been in the conversation somewhere, I've been dropping in and out, but I'd love to hear what has been one of your greatest sort of challenges. You've been hugely successful in your career. And I can imagine there's been a number of different challenges, but if you had to sort of pick one of the biggest challenges out, which one would it be, and how did you actually overcome it?
Thank you, Marvin. Sure. So, yeah, there's lots of different challenges and they come in different forms. I would say that you know, my age is, I'm sure, no secret at this point. I'm 58 years old. But at the time that I was, I think, in my early executive roles in Raytheon and, excuse me, Walmart and even Prudential, I really was the only woman in the boardroom. And it was very challenging. And being the only girl in a male-dominated environment had lots of it was a minefield in many cases. But I think this is true in almost any situation when someone is trying. I see this with younger career people today. When you're faced with challenges and you're having to prove yourself, or having to really, you've already got this, even if you've already have the seat at the table, but you're having to feel as though you have to justify your being there. There's a tendency to always jump in and to always want to participate or to contribute and to prove and to demonstrate. See, this is why I'm here. You see the value I can add. Let me tell you how we ought to solve this problem. Let me map out the solution for this. Let me show you how you ought to do this. And I think it's natural, especially if you're a type A, very driven personality, which I certainly am. But what I learned, thank heavens, with great coaches and mentors along the way, was to be very judicious about choosing the hill you're going to die on. It is so much more powerful. If I could give anybody guidance, when you think about mentors and people that you want to be your coach or your mentor, and you're shaping in your mind who you want to be in your career, you see yourself in that corner office with your name placard on the wall, et cetera. Also think about the type of person and character that you want to be. And find that role model around you that you say, wow, of all these people in the room, aside from the titles and the prestige that they have or the rank that they have, who has the most influence? And I found early on when I decided that I wanted to be the person in the room that wasn't necessarily the loudest at the table and didn't always have the right answer for everything, but I wanted to be the person that when huge dialogue was going on and conversations were being had and people were trying to solve a problem and they came to a conclusion in a big important room, and then they would all stop and turn around and go, what do you think, Julie? And with one word, I could unravel 45 minutes of dialogue. And I planted in my mind that I want people to understand that when I come forward with a solution, there is no agenda, that I am being transparent, that I will be forthright and honest, and I will be thoughtful about my suggestions, and I will consider the people, and I will consider the how as much as I consider the what we will do. And that mattered to me. And when I did that, I spoke less, but I had 10 times more impact. I hope that was helpful. Did that answer your question?
Absolutely. And thank you. Thank you very much for that. I can see Anna's flashing. You want to pass the mic over. Thanks a lot. I'm done speaking.
Spoke less, but had more of an impact. I think that is a great share. Well, as Marvin said, we're passing the mic. We might as well. Marvin is co-moderating the room for us this morning now. Thank you, Marvin. Appreciate it. We might as well. Anna, we'll come to you next as you're flashing away.
Thank you so much, Paul. Thank you so much for having me, Ashley. And Julie, Marvin, thank you also for this beautiful question that you asked. And Julie, oh my goodness, wow. Just hearing the last share, not only are you such an amazingly accomplished C-suite executive and just you've done amazing things with your life, but you're also one amazing woman and human being. So I'm honored to be here with you. Thank you so much.
Very kind of you. Incredible.
No, I mean it. I've spent my life, my youth, helping young people for 17 years. Our offices were inside a Fortune 500 company, Southern California Edison, and actually in their corporate headquarters. And so I got to really pretty much grow up inside a company, being inside of it, but not part of it. I also served on the Harvard Women's Leadership Board, dedicating our mission is to help promote women and girls globally. Also, I served on the advisory board for Merrill Lynch to help promote women and figure out how women can advance. And I was just reading a report recently that until today, in 2021, the number of women in CEO women in corporate America or large corporations, it's just merely 7.8%. Yet when we look at the number of graduates from MBA schools, the number is 39%. And for law schools, it's 54%. And gender equity, gender intelligence, looking at the brain differences between men and women, that's what we did a lot at Harvard, discussed a lot with experts. And so I wanted to get your input and your ideas as to how women can be potentially promoted faster. I mean, to say that by 2025, we'll have 15% of women CEOs, I think that's still a dismal number, given that we make up 50%. And as we know, when we bring women to the table, they contribute to the productivity at the company. And just from your share, we can see how amazing you are. So what do you think needs to be done to improve those numbers and to help promote women and bring them to the table as equal partners? Thank you so much.
Well, I don't think there's any one quick answer. I think it's everyone has a role to play in making this happen, both for women and for people of color. For me, mentors and coaches were a big part of my success. And they were, when I say that, I mean the lion's share of my success were mentors and coaches along the way. If you'll forgive me, and I'm going to, I'll tell a quick story, but when I was, I'll try to condense this very, very quickly. When I was at Raytheon, of course, and this would have been my first big corporate job. And this was 1998. And at that time, Raytheon, was like most companies. I mean, there weren't a lot of women in the executive boardroom for certainly, but in this defense contractor, military-led business, part of the industrial complex, there were virtually none. And I was the only woman that wasn't answering telephones or serving coffee in group meetings. And they would openly call me the skirt. They would literally in meetings, they would say, I don't know, ask the skirt. And that might seem horrific now. And of course, in today's world, that is horrific, but it was actually a term of endearment at that point. It was a different world. It was a very different environment. The point I want to make is in that environment, we cycled through CEOs and we were on our third CEO in the space of 3 years. And he had an occasion to see me in action with my team at a trade show on a Thursday afternoon. And Monday morning, he came by the office. And of course, I was there at 7:30 in the morning, and he called me into his office and he said, do you have a resume? And I did that horrible thing that women do that I hate. I've done in my career where you get that little nervous laugh, you know, and you make some lame comment like, oh, do I need one? You know? And he said, yeah, bring it down to my office. And I said, well, it's out of date. And he said, well, that's a shame. Bring it anyway. And I sat there with him while he read the entire resume and he put it down on the table and he looked at me and he said, so how long have you wanted to be an actress? And I remember I was gobsmacked. I thought, what is it? What's in there that would even remotely imply that? And I said, I've never wanted to be an actress. He said, then why is it that you think if you show up every morning before everybody else and you leave late after everybody else and you spend your day cleaning up everyone else's, excuse my language, shit, that you're going to be discovered? And I said, I don't know. And he said, I've been here 4 months and I learned more about you in 30 minutes yesterday than I've learned about you in 4 months. Whose fault is that? Mine or yours? And I said, well, I guess it's mine. He said, you're damn right it's yours. And so I say that because for two reasons. Number one, we have to, and this is not just aimed at women. It's anybody, a person in their career. We have to consciously decide that we're going to manage our careers and not have them manage us or just float through life and wait for the next offer that may or may not come. That's one point. But the second point is that man taking the time to come by my office and say, come to my office and sit there with me and hit me in the head with that 2x4, changed the trajectory of my career. And I literally that day, that evening after work, went back and built a marketing plan for myself that I follow to this day. But in that process, I also wrote plans and programs that I launched at Walmart and many other places where I tutored thousands of women and young career professionals. That man, by making that decision to come by my office that morning, take the time to sit with me and say, get your head out of your backside changed the lives and the careers of, I can say this honestly, thousands of people. And every one of us in this room right now has an opportunity to do the same thing multiple times over. We have to decide that we're going to be conscious and aware in the moment and take those opportunities when they come. This is Julie, and I hope that answered your question. I'm sorry if it was too long.
No, it's amazing. Thank you so much. That's why.
Wow, absolutely fascinating insight. We're all sat in the studio going, I can't believe what Julie's had to, or what Julie must have had to overcome to get to the position that she's been in. And Lucy went, I bet she's had to swallow her tongue so many times across her career based on what you were saying. Like I say, the fact that ask the skirt was a term of endearment, it just shows, wow, how far we've come, luckily, I guess, but how far we've still got to go. And, it brings up Lucien's point earlier of this sort of unconscious bias that we have, and that, you know, us, white men are just kind of ignorant to this world that we don't even know it exists. But I think it's probably our role and our responsibility to educate ourselves, because nobody else is going to do it for us, are they, fundamentally? Right, Modern Speakers, we've only got a few more minutes of Julie's precious time. So flash your mic if you'd love to ask this wonderful human being and top level performer a question. Let's go to, there's loads of people flashing their mics. Let's go to Dimple. Dimple, what's your question, my friend?
Thanks so much, James. Julie, wow. That last question that you answered, I just want to say, absolutely, I got goosebumps throughout my body. It shifted me. So thank you so much for that. And so forgive me, I've been in and out of the conversations if this has been covered, but my question to you is, you are such an incredible role model and inspiration, not just for women, but for whoever desires something more in their lives. And so my question is, was there a moment in your childhood where you absolutely knew that you were going to make a difference to thousands and thousands of people? And what was that like? Could you describe that? Thank you.
Wow, Dimple, that's a great question. Great question. I hope I don't disappoint you, but I would tell you no. The short answer is no. I never really thought, I always thought that I would be successful because I knew that I would work extremely hard and I knew that I was resilient. And I had, like everybody, we had, you know, a tough childhood. My mother was a raging alcoholic. Parents went through divorces. I mean, I had some of those challenges that made me certainly stronger and resilient. So I always knew that I would be successful, but I never really thought that I would make a difference in people's lives. I would say that came later when I was implementing that marketing plan for myself and I was watching it work. And I thought at that point, I have to do for others. I have to send the elevator back down. I have to do for others what that man did for me. And at that moment, I knew, but not as a child. No, I'm sorry, I didn't. This is Julie.
Thank you so much, Julie. Thank you so much for being the inspiration that you are to us all. And yeah, it just goes to show that, you know, through our lives and through our childhood, that those things that we believe are challenges actually are the things that strengthen us and make us create the resilience that we desire to move us forward. So I appreciate the conversation with you today. God bless you. Thank you.
Fantastic stuff, and thank you. What a great insight. I felt like it was almost your duty to send the elevator back down. What a difference of momentum that you will give yourself when you wake up every single day with that as your driver. Not I want to achieve, but I've got to get to where I need to get so that I can send that elevator back down. Beautiful insight there. Modern Speakers, flash your mics if you'd love to ask this wonderful lady a question. The global CMO of multiple brands, but more than that, somebody who has strong-armed her way through adversity to actually have her seat at the table and have other people, build a table that other people come to sit at her table now. She's not sitting at anybody else's. Serial entrepreneur and just a wonderful human being. Well, this has been one of my favourite conversations we've had so far, I've got to be honest. Since we've started in January, this is probably, in fact, I'm going to chuck out, this is my favourite conversation so far that we've ever had on the Winners Club. There you go. I'm calling it as my fave. So, guys, we've only got a little while longer, so flash your mics if you would like to ask a question. Dr. Nashita, let's come to you next.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for bringing me up on stage, and thank you so much, Julie. I've been listening very intently. If there's background noise, it's because my car tyres are being changed as we speak, so I'll be quick. Julie, you mentioned a lot of things that speak very much to my own passions. You've talked about, you know, your background coming from Brazil, growing up, the importance of language. I heard you talk about win-wins. I've heard you talk about influencing. So my question is, when you're now looking at people who are coming up through the corporate ladder and they're looking to become leaders, looking to get into the kind of positions that you're in, what are the skills that you think they should really develop apart from their core business knowledge that they need for their role? But what are those kinds of skills that you think, yeah, that's really what makes a difference when you're navigating a very complex or difficult corporate world? I'm Dr. Nash, I'm done speaking. Thank you.
Thank you for the question, Dr. Nash. So what I believe is the absolute core platform skill is listen. The ability to listen and then truly listen and truly hear people. And it requires the ability to be in the moment. I'm sure you all realize that the word listen and the word silent are made up of the exact same letters. You can't listen if you're talking, and you can't listen if you're thinking about what you're going to say when you start talking again. And I believe that it's more challenging now than ever in my career history. With technology, with whether it's COVID that's keeping us remote and divided, many of the subtle cues of really listening, the body language, watching people's face inflection, being able to look them in the eyes, a lot of that is compromised, but there's still the ability to listen. And I think it's the magic of this app in Clubhouse, right? Because you can hear the passion in somebody's voice, or you can hear if they're distracted or if they're multitasking, but the ability to truly listen, the insight that you gain, the ability to negotiate, to understand what is important to both sides of the table. If you can do that and master technology, I think you'll be very successful in your career. I hope that helped.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for the answer. Thank you. I'm done speaking.
Amazing. Thank you very much. Well, we know we only had a limited time with Julie, so we have got just time for one more question. So mods and speakers, flash your mics like mad men and women if you've got something that you'd love to ask Julie. Flash your mics, guys, if you'd love to ask Julie a question. Jan, have you unmuted to ask a question, or are we in your pocket? No, I thought not. Right, who have we got here? Let's go to Charisse. Hopefully I've pronounced your name correctly. Charisse, what's your question for Julie?
You pronounced it perfectly. Thank you so much.
Goodness.
And Julie, this is such an honor to be here on tonight. You know, I'm in the States as well, so it's 1:30 in the morning, and my children happen to have a sleepover with their cousins tonight, so I'm still up because we had movie night, and I'm so happy that I'm still up to catch this conversation. I grabbed my pencil and paper. I'm over here taking notes because so much of what you're saying is just so profound, and it could literally be framed and put on my wall. So thank you so much for the value that you're bringing tonight and all that you're sharing. So I'm a mother of 6 children. 5 of them are girls. And so as a woman who's made such an impact in this world and who has done so much, my question to you is, what is important for me to nurture in my children? And what is important for me to exemplify as a woman? Not necessarily as their mother, but as a woman. What would be an important thing for me to exemplify for these 5 girls that I'm raising? And what would be important for me to nurture in them, aside from homework and sleeping and eating well and emotional intelligence? Like, what would you say is one of the things that kind of raised you into being the woman that you are today? That's my question. And thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Charisse, and thank you for staying up so late. It's my pleasure to be here. And if you have 6 children, God bless you. What's important to nurture in young girls, I think, is a sense of self. More than anything else, the courage to be okay with who they are, exactly the way they are, and to really understand that for any shortcoming they believe they have, it might be just their perception, number one. And number two, they have a strength that is equal to or greater than that within them as well. And they have to choose whether or not they're going to focus on what makes them stronger or what makes them weaker. I have a younger sister. She's 7 years younger than I, but I often would tell her, are you, you know, if your mind is hardware, what software are you running on it? Are you running a software, a Windows program from 1995 about what your shortcomings were that decade or that year so long ago? Choose to be consciously competent and strong and confident in yourself. I think that is the most important gift young women can have. And then generally, I would say young boys or girls, grace and humility. There is strength in grace and humility. You don't have to be the smartest one in the room. In fact, you'll get farther if you're not. And leaders don't climb their way to the top. They're carried there. So be sure that you focus on creating teams behind you that are more invested in your success because they don't want to disappoint you, not because they're afraid of you. Be strong by being gentle and being conscious and choose your moments to assert yourself and believe in yourself and help others believe in themselves, and you'll be just fine. I hope that helps.
It does. Thank you so much. And I cannot write fast enough, but you all said you're recording and it's going to be somewhere. So I'm going to find this podcast so I can rewrite down all the notes from that. This was just so beautiful. Thank you so much, Julie.
It will be on the Winners Club podcast, which actually, if you click on my face or Ashley's face or James's face at the top, I'm Paul with the blue background. You can go through to the page on our associate app and there's a button on there that says subscribe to the podcast. So you'll be able to catch up with this interview when it comes up. Julie, we've got one last question from you. Everybody that was in the room earlier today, the speakers and the moderators, we asked them a question. If you was to disappear off of this planet tomorrow, what would be the one piece of advice you would give to somebody? And we've asked that to all of the moderators and speakers that have come onto the stage today. So we're going to give you that question. If you was to disappear off of the planet tomorrow, what's the one piece of advice you would give to somebody today?
Oh, wow. Good question. Paul, wow, that stumped me. So I guess I would say choose your timing. You can have so much greater impact or influence if you choose your timing. And whether that's when you take a stand or when you pull somebody aside and give them feedback or when you ask for something for yourself, when you request something or negotiate something, timing is everything. And it doesn't all have to happen now. That would be my best advice.
Wow. Brilliant, Julie. Thank you very much. Round of applause, everybody, for Julie Lyle being here this morning. Thank you so much, Julie. Flash your microphones, please, guys, as a sign of appreciation.
Are you allowed to just whoop and cheer someone's name like a Julie? Can I just shout, Julie? Is that all right?
Love you, Julie.
Julie, thank you so much.
John, thank you so much, all of you.
Thank you for spending the time with us. Your night time now, isn't it? But thank you for spending the time with us here this morning. It's been an absolute pleasure from us. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Winners Club. If you have taken some practical lessons and learnings from some of the most impactful conversations on Clubhouse, then we would love your support for this show by leaving us a 5-star review wherever you download your podcasts.